seconds to turn around. That's Gene Pitney here in the Scott Regan Show for a Monday night. I've just figured out right here that if I save for the next 20 years at the rate I've been saving for the past 6 months, I can retire at the age of 60 and owe $100,000.
WKNR presents
the Keener13.com podcast.
Welcome to a special edition of the Keener 13 podcast. I'm Scott Westerman, and tonight we take you back to 1965 when WKNR welcomed Gene Pitney to the Scott Regan Show. We bring it to you uncut, just as it aired 41 years ago.
Motor City Music.
Our guest tonight on the Scott Regan Show is Gene Pitney. Gene, welcome to Detroit.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
What's happening? What's going on?
We've been running all over the place. We're on a promotional tour.
Mm-hmm.
Been running around from Boston to Philadelphia to Baltimore to Detroit to Cleveland. And mm-hmm. I'm tired, man. I'm tired. Mm-hmm.
How long have you been in the business, Gene?
First successful record was about 61.
Mm-hmm. Had you done anything before that, recording-wise?
Recorded twice. I was Billy Bryan on Blaze Records, and I was Jamie of Jamie and Jane on Decca.
Very good.
We sold about 10 copies between the two trips around. My mother has 9.
Mm. So how long have you been in the business now altogether?
Well, 2 years before that, 61, 5, 6, about 7 years, 6.5
about
years.
About 7 years. Where are you born?
Born in Hartford, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. I've always lived in Rockville, Connecticut, just outside of town, a little town.
Mm-hmm. The first big record you had was I Want to Love My Life Away.
That's right. That was 61.
61, right. How did you happen to pick on that particular song and grab a hold of it to record it?
We didn't really pick on it. I was not recording at the time as an artist. I was writing songs for mm-hmm. other people. And this song was actually recorded as a demonstration record to be presented to some other artists to record. And the interesting thing about that song is it cost about $40 to make the whole thing, because
really?
I sang all the voices on it.
Did you really?
And I played the guitar, I played the piano, and I played the drums. It was all overdubbed instrumentation. Other than, I guess, the bass. The bass and the actual basic rhythm on the drums was two people mm-hmm. in the studio.
Did you think you were going to have a big hit like that when you originally cut the song?
No, absolutely not. I had a few things that were successful as a songwriter about the same time.
What
matter
did
fact,
you have?
I think during I Want to Love My Life Away, Rubber Ball, the Bobby V, was a big record for me that was written by myself. And then following that, moving up about 3 releases later with Only Love Can Break a Heart,
mm-hmm.
It went to number 2 for me, and the number 1 record in the country at the time was He's a Rebel by the Crystals, which
mm-hmm.
I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time He's a Rebel fell out of number 1, mine slipped from number 2, and I never made number 1. So I killed myself with the songs I wrote. I had number 1 and 2 at the same time.
All right, let's give the first big Gene Pitney hit a whirl here. I Want to Love My Life Away.
Okay, great.
Yeah!
Before we played I Want to Love My Life Away, we were talking about songwriting. and the fact that you had a couple of big hits going, you know, besides the songs that you were singing yourself. How would, and I get many letters like this, people are always asking, you know, how do you become a songwriter? How do you become a singer? You know, what do you do? Where do you go? What advice could you give for somebody if they wanted to be a songwriter?
I get the same, you know, questions actually most of the time. It's very difficult, and yet it's very simple, because I think primarily today it comes down to the fact of doing one thing as an approach to getting into songwriting. I would say that if you're interested in pop songwriting, you'd have to go to New York. It's almost a necessity. And on the other hand, I think that the songs you write almost have to be on demonstration record. In other words, on a disc already. But if you brought in a tape, or if you came in and played it yourself for someone, or if you brought in a tape to a publishing office in New York, I say the odds would be 9 out of 10 that you wouldn't even get listened to. It's almost the business now that's down to 100% dubs or forget it. Nobody wants to listen to you.
Do you think that the songwriting field is, there's too much, too many songwriters, it's too crowded, the field is too crowded, the music field in general?
No, I think that's one piece of it that can never be too crowded, and I'll base this on myself. I know every time I come up for a session, I'll give you an example. About 2.5 months back, I recorded 16 sides. I was looking for a new single, an LP, and possibly a single following the one that's out right now, because I knew I wouldn't have a chance to record again until, say, sometime into at least July or August, whereas I would need two singles. And trying to find 16 sides that I thought were capable of being singles, in other words, very, very strong sides, it could be a 45 record, it's almost impossible. You can't. I went through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs, and I think that the amount of good songs, most of the good writers today are signed up to publishing firms that are associated with a record company. As a result, the material goes to that record company. And for a freelance writer or soliciting publishers for material for oneself, if you can write yourself, you're really in business. It's a great advantage to have going for you.
Who would you say are the top pop writers today?
Pop writers today? Well, a couple of years back, it used to be Carole King and Jerry Goffin were probably the strongest twosome, Screen Gems Columbia, and now I think Barry
Mann. I think we should mention some of their tunes. They had Locomotion, and they had...
They had so many, I wouldn't even take a shot at saying which ones, but I would say, let's see, 66, 64, well, let's say through 63 and 64, they probably had about, between the 2 years, maybe
Chains
20 top 10
by
things.
By the Cookies, I think all the Cookies songs, Chains and... what were some of the
Those songs were all on Dimension, weren't they? Which was the affiliated label from the publishing company.
Right.
But there were so many, and I think the rest of them were actually bigger records that were done by, I don't know, the Drifters did a packet of their things. Singers. I did one thing myself. Matter of fact, following I Want to Love My Life Away, Every Breath I Take, Every Little Breath I Take was the name of the song, which is one of their earlier efforts when they were just becoming a team.
That was the one right after I Want to Love My Life Away.
It was Two Beyond. There was a thing that didn't happen called A Louisiana Mama. Which kind of died a very
good
quick
song,
death.
Though.
Yeah, I liked it too, but nobody else seemed to, so it didn't really happen. Story behind... Yeah, I guess there is. It's an interesting thing. I was talking about a couple nights ago that in the booth, while I was recording this in the studio, there was a group of talent as producers that probably, if you tried to put them all together today, first of all, you couldn't, but have turned into fantastically successful people that were all there producing this session that same night. In the booth was Bacharach and David, who I didn't get to, but I think are the most successful writing group pop in the last couple of years.
Yeah, let's see, Bacharach and Dave. Well, they've done all the Dionne Warwick songs.
All the Dionne Warwick. What's New Pussycat.
Right.
Kentucky Bluebird, or what do you call it? The thing is out right now. Michael?
Yeah.
Message to
Michael.
That's a Dionne Warwick, right? Phil Spector, who was Phyllis Records and all the Crystals and...
Bobby Socks and the Blue Jeans, Darlene Love, the Ronettes.
Wrote and produced all of those things. He was in the booth. Lieber and Stoller, which is what Redbird Records today, and have been writing hits since the early 1950s.
All the Coasters hits were
right,
Lieber
all
and
the
Stoller,
early things.
Right. And all these people.
Schroeder and Gold were in there that did a lot of my earlier things. All these people in one booth kind of drove me crazy, but they were all there, you know.
And this was before some of them had really turned into...
Almost all of them.
People in their...
Hadn't really happened at all. It was kind of a wealth of talent in there at one time. And this is what came out of it.
I hardly ever thank the stars above for sending me your very precious love. You'll never hear me say a prayer, but thanks to someone way up there who gave me such a lucky break. Oh no, darling, only with every breath I take. And every time we have to be
apart. I hardly ever find you in my heart. And when it comes to thinking of the thought of losing all your love, I never worry how my heart would ache. Oh no, darling, with every little breath I take, only with every little beat of my heart. And every single minute I'm every little breath I take, only with every little step I make, only with every little beat of my heart.
Gene, let's get back to some of the big writers and talents of today. I think we've covered just about everybody there is. Is there anybody else you can think of offhand that you want to talk about?
Well, you know, it's really true that I'm talking about, which I guess is normal in anybody's business, the people that I run into or I see or I'm aware of after a while. But I think you can't leave out Holland and Dozier, who are they're from out here.
And Holland, you forgot, there's three of them, you know.
Oh, Holland and Dozier,
No, it's Holland, Dozier, and Holland.
Oh, Holland, Dozier, and Holland.
yeah, see, it's Brian Holland, and then Lamont Dozier and Eddie Holland, who had a couple of records by himself.
Maybe if you take them into consideration, they're probably the hottest.
At the present time,
group.
Yeah.
The reason I said before I thought Bacharach and David possibly are the hottest of the year is I think that the appeal of Bacharach and David worldwide, that some of the things they've been doing motion picture-wise and everything, some of the scores and What's New Pussycat and things like that, and the Jack Jones have been all over the world, you know, where some of the things here are basically in this country and giants, and you can't knock it at all. But there's four or five writing teams that just don't stop. They're just success after success after
success.
What
do you think of the Beatles' writing efforts?
I think the wildest thing that they did, you know, I did a tour over there a little while back, a couple of months ago, and one night I came out on stage and I took a look to see if the show was going. It was my package, and it was after the intermission. Halfway intermission, and I looked and I saw this fella on the side with the offstage mic to introduce the second half of the show, and he just looked wrong because it was a pretty heavy fella that was actually doing this for us on the tour, and it was a thin guy there, and I looked a little closer in the dark and he had a big long beard, about a 3 or 4 days growth, and a bottle of wine in his hand, and I thought, what in the world is that? And I got up closer and it was Paul McCartney. And
you're putting me on.
I don't know how he got in the place, even though how he got in the show I'll never know. And on the other side of the stage was Herman. They somehow crept in the theater with, you know, people were looking for the people that were on the show, and nobody was expecting them to be there. So if I ever went on and ever mentioned, the place would have been destroyed. The whole building would have been taken down. But the reason I say this is he told us that night that he was going to write some songs, Lennon were going to write some songs, that they were very interested to see if they could write a hit song, if they were strong enough without the Beatle name attached. Mm-hmm. And they finally did it with this woman, the Peter and Gordon thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the name of, I don't know what it was, Jonathan Krebs or something like that, is the name on the record.
Yeah.
And it's a great song, you know, and very successful without their name on it. And then they finally, somebody found out because it was Macklin Publishing over here.
Right.
And they followed it through. So, of course, they're successful and fantastically successful.
Yeah, they're great talents.
Sure.
Great talents. Let's see, After Every Little Breath I Take, the next big Gene Pitney hit was...
Only Love Can Break a Heart, and If I Didn't Have a Dime, they were two sides. It was a two-sided one for me.
Darling,
kiss. Only love can break a heart. Only love can mend it again. Give me a chance to make up for the harm I've done. Try to forgive me and let's keep the two.
Music is today. I remember once I was talking to Phil Spector, who we were talking about earlier, in New York, and he said to me that he could take me, and believe me, I really can't sing. Definitely
right.
Forget it.
Yeah.
And he said that he could take me and, with the proper song and the proper arrangement, make me a big recording star.
I believe that.
Phil Spector said that. And so the point that I wanted to make was, listening to your records and never seeing you perform at all, it was really difficult to tell whether or not you were a talent or, you know, you were just a product of a producer with a sound.
Well, that's not true. If I can break in before I lose my train of thought here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it depends upon, I agree with that philosophy completely, except it depends upon if the song, see, Phil Spector is a producer and production is his plus.
Right.
And when that's the kind of a record you make, his kind of records, I agree, you can take pretty much anyone. Put them into the vocal slot because the record is a production record. But if you take a song that has to be sung, that's a melodic song and has to have a lyric interpretation, I don't think you can ever do that with anyone, which most of the songs I do are that kind of a song.
The thing besides the record, Town Without Pity, that really turned me on you was I saw you on television one night, and I really don't know what show it was. I think it was Shindig or... Oh, just one of those shows, and it had to be before I came to Detroit, since I don't get to see
those
shows.
What did we do on the show? What was being done?
I don't know what song you sang. It was a ballad, and it was a very big ballad, and take it for what it's worth, you gave me goosebumps.
Oh, well, that's
watching
great.
You.
I mean, it was a great compliment, you know.
Terrific. Really
Thank
terrific.
You very much.
Really terrific. Let's give Town Without Pity a little whirlerino.
Here it is, Dmitri Tiomkin's song, Town Without Pity.
Joy can't last. can do. Survive when these little minds tear you in two. What a town without pity can do. No, it isn't very pretty. What a town without pity can do.
Gene Pitney, our special guest, and we are up to the next Gene Pitney hit, which was Mecca.
Yeah, this was a beauty. This was one that it was a good, very good success for me here. But you know, as well, it was released in England. You know, the lyric to this, it's again a very odd lyric. I live on the east side, she lives on the west side of the street. Though they say that east is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this kind of a lyric, and being the title Mecca, I met this girl who's on. I guess she, Screen Jam, I don't know if she records a Columbia or Epic or one of Colpix, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Toni Wine.
Mm-hmm.
And a very big talent writing-wise, and I think record-wise, she's going to get off the ground very quick. But I met her one day outside of 1650 Broadway, the writing building in New York, and her mother was with her. And her mother's a nice little Jewish lady that comes over about 4 feet tall, real short one. You know?
Yeah.
And she walked over and she said, Mama, I'd like you to meet Gene Pitney. And she looked up at me and she said, oh, it's him, it's Gene Pitney. She said, tell me. She said, did they ever get together? Did it ever happen? I never met her before. So I thought, oh, I've got one here. I said, what do you mean, did it happen? Did they ever get together? She says, you know, in the song, she says, did one ever get across to the other, to the border? And it took me about an hour. You won't believe what she thought that story meant.
Oh, isn't that something?
She thought that the boy or the girl was in Israel, and that whoever the other party was in...
Egypt. Yeah.
And that I live on the east side, she lives on the west side of the street, and she thought that here they are looking across the border and can't get to one another. She says, did it ever happen? She said, did they ever get together?
No kidding.
What an interpretation. Boy, that woman has some imagination.
That's terrific. That is really something.
That's my story.
Very, very good.
Here it is now, Mecca.
Well, I want to know if they ever did get together. No, I'm only kidding.
Let's see.
Let's give it a whirl and see what happens.
Okay.
I live on the west side, she lives on the east side of the street. And though they say that east is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet, each morning I face the window and pray that our love can be.
Let's see. Liberty Valance was the next one. That's from a movie. That's a great movie.
John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart, Edmund O'Brien and
Lee
Marvin.
That's a great combination when you get two guys like James Stewart and John Wayne together in one Western.
The other two aren't so bad either. They're two of my favorites. Yeah, the other
O'Brien,
two people,
yeah,
Edmund O'Brien and Lee Marvin. Yeah, fantastic.
Terrific, yeah. Lee Marvin played Liberty Valance.
That's right.
How'd you get to record this particular song?
Well, Town Without Pity was so successful, you know, for the movie in front of it, that naturally we had a whole pile of motion picture scores thrown at us after this. Mm-hmm. But the thing I was interested in was a lot of the movies had like a very good song but a very weak picture. And other ones had a very weak picture and a very good song. So this was the only one that came close with a great... I didn't think the picture was that strong, but I knew it would be a big movie with John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, and so forth and so on, with all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And the song, I was very interested. It was very odd and very unique. And as a matter of fact, I remember when this was out, I was in Texas doing my basic training for Uncle Sam.
Very good.
And it was a big hit down there because it was a little bit country, you know, and Texas is a big country market.
Mm-hmm. Uncle Sam burned my draft card.
He burned your draft card?
When I went
to
my physical, yes. Listen, you didn't play the violin at the beginning of this record, did you?
No, but if I tell you who did...
You've got to tell me.
We had the lead violinist from the date. In other words, if we had 12 violins, there's always a concert violinist who's your lead violinist.
Right.
Well, we asked him if he would play this riff straight. He wasn't trying to play it odd or off-key or country. He was trying to play that straight. And it was so off-key and so wrong... And we knew it was, but it sounded good. It had an interesting sound that we didn't dare play it back into the studio because we knew the guy would go crazy. So here he is now trying to play it straight, and listen to what he does to it.
When Liberty Valance rode to town, the women folk would hide. They'd hide. When Liberty Valance walked around, the men would step aside. 'Cause the point of a gun was the only law that Liberty understood. When it came to shooting straight and fast, he was mighty good. From out of the east, a stranger came, a law book in his hand. Oh, man. The kind of a man the West would need to tame a troubled land. 'Cause the point of a gun was the only law that Liberty understood. When it came to shooting straight and fast, he was mighty good. Many a man would face his gun, and many a man would fall. The man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance. He was the bravest of them all. The love of a girl can make a man stay on when he should go. Stay on, just trying to build a peaceful life where love is free to grow. But the point of a gun was the only law that Liberty understood. When the final showdown came at last, a law book was no good. Alone and afraid, she prayed that he'd return that fateful night. Oh, that night, when nothing she said could keep her man from going out to fight. From the moment a girl gets to be full grown, the very first thing she learns, when two men go out to face each other, only one returns. Everyone heard two shots ring out. One shot made Liberty fall. The man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance. He was the bravest of them all. The man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance. He was the bravest of them all.
That's Gene Pitney, as heard on The Scott Regan Show in 1965. Gene Pitney passed away suddenly this week in England. He had just completed a concert in Wales, performing to a standing ovation.
And so you cry a little bit
to be in love.
Little bit
to be in love,
day and night, night and day. It hurts to be in love this way.
Gene Pitney charted 10 times on Keener, beginning with a Burt Bacharach tune that held down the number 10 spot on the very first WKNR Music Guide in November of 1963.
Dearest, darling, I had to write to say that I won't be home anymore, for something happened to me while I was driving home, and I'm not the same anymore. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. I saw a welcoming light and stopped to rest for the night.
That's a taste of 24 Hours from Tulsa, which debuted at number 10 on the first WKNR Music Guide in November of 1963. Before he became a solo artist, Gene Pitney was a writer, and in 1962, Phil Spector used his talents to pen a top 10 WKMH smash for Darlene Love during her tenure as the lead singer of The Crystals. He's a Rebel, written in 1962 by the late Gene Pitney. Another piece of Pitney trivia is the fact that he was the writing talent behind a very important hit for Ricky Nelson, who's often erroneously credited as the author of
Hello, Mary Lou, Goodbye Heart, Sweet Mary Lou, I'm so in love with you. I knew Mary Lou, we never part, so hello, Mary Lou, goodbye, heart.
Hello, Mary Lou was recorded by no less than four other notable bands, including Led Zeppelin, Creedence, the Statler Brothers, and Queen. In 1964, Gene Pitney broke into the Keener Top 30 with the first Mick Jagger, Keith Richards composition to reach the United States. And it's something that sounds distinctly unlike the Rolling Stones.
Last night I needed you.
Written by Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, That Girl Belongs to Yesterday lasted just 1 week on the WKNR Music Guide, a full 6 months before the Stones' first Keener hit.
There's a girl who lives down the track in a little shack made of timber wood, and her clothes are all hand-me-downs from the folks in town who treat her so good.
Gene Pitney's Keener career also included Looking Through the Eyes of Love, Princess in Rags, I Must Be Seeing Things, Backstage, She's a Heartbreaker, and one of my favorites, Last Chance to Turn Around.
The wheels of my old car are turning, burning up the highway. Tonight that girl of mine will be yearning for not learning to see things my way.
The distinctive voice of Gene Pitney on the Keener Podcast. You can read more about the life and times of this great artist at our number one reference for 60s rock and roll, allmusic.com. And special thanks to Bob Green, who contributed the master tapes of Scott Regan's 1965 interview. For Keener13.com, I'm Scott Westerman.
I won't back down. Last takes it to Brooklyn. Last chance to turn around. Last.
keep these wheels of mine covering ground. On the last exit to Brooklyn, the last chance to turn around, the last exit to Brooklyn, the last chance to turn around.
A copyrighted feature and may not be reproduced in whole.